you need to create the context, patterns of information that combine to provide substance. I talk about the mosaic of the crime. It's like a puzzle you put together to get a picture. Okay? And the goal here is we have this puzzle we put together that says, it's Joe. Joe did it. Here's his picture put together in this puzzle. Now, somebody's going to say, yeah, look, there's a piece missing in that puzzle. It's his earlobe. Okay? And I'm going to say, you're right, there's a piece missing in this puzzle. It looks like if that piece were there, it would show his earlobe. But I don't know. It could be that if you actually took that piece, it would be the evidence that got him off, right? It might be that's the radio device that controls his brain from afar. He's actually a robot. But it sure looks like Joe. Okay? I mean, it looks like the puzzle. It's a picture of Joe. Yeah, it's possible there could be some exculpatory evidence out there, but I've built up enough of a picture so it sure looks like Joe. Unless, you know, I couldn't find any. If somebody else can find some, then that's of value. But if you can't find it, we're just going to have to go with what we have. I mean, we have a puzzle. It's never going to be perfect. It's also easily misinterpreted. It's often misleading, in fact. Very often, you'll have people that intentionally corrupt information or intentionally go through an intermediary to commit a crime or obscure their return address. Might get email from somebody who claims to be from Alaska. You trace it back, it's from Boston. Right? Might be that they're actually from Alaska. They're just accessing a computer in Boston. I don't know. And it can be misleading. What you need to do is track it down. Right? That's what investigation is about. That's what they call an investigation. You've got to track it down. You know, follow the leads. And often it's just patently false. I mean, made up, fake by people. So I want to talk a little bit more about latency. There are a lot of different types of systems and a lot of corresponding types of tools. And one of the big problems we have is with the proliferation of different types of tapes and disk drives and other kinds of media and computers and operating systems and programs and databases and formats, we're getting an increasingly high load of different mechanisms for interpreting information and different representations of information in different forms that those representations are stored in. If I have a record from an MVS system sitting on a magnetic tape somewhere, I have to analyze that differently and present it differently than something that's on your Palm 3. It's different stuff. Okay, so we need to have the means to understand, analyze, and present information from a variety of different sources in a variety of different forms with a variety of different meanings associated with them. Turns out, a lot of effort might go into getting the information. You might have to get a subpoena to get the information, right? You might have to go through a great deal of paperwork to get access to the account that somebody used to get their account on Yahoo. Right? You need another email account to get an email account on Yahoo, so they can send you the confirming message and they can identify who you are. Well, if I want to find out who you are, and I go to Yahoo and say, tell me who you are, they'll say, go away. What I need is a search warrant. Okay, so if I get a warrant, then I can go to Yahoo and do that. So some of this evidence takes a lot of effort, right? If I have something encoded in some encrypted format on the deleted areas of the bad bulk blocks of a disk, that's going to be a lot of time and effort to go pull that evidence out. It's also a lot of time and effort to store it that way, but that's another issue. So getting at that evidence and having all the necessary materials and expertise and so forth to get at it can be a lot of work. It's not like a piece of paper that says the Brooklyn Bridge. Physical trace evidence. Hey, everybody gets into this whole computer funk, you know, they say everything's bits and bytes. Okay, if I'm going to make a case against somebody, and I say he was using this computer, how do I prove he's using the computer? By some magical password? buy a videotape? I mean, do I have to put in a bugging device? Hey, how about fingerprints? He's got his fingerprints on the keyboard. He used the computer. Done. Hair samples. Particles of skin. These are things that fall into the keyboard of the computer. Coca-Cola cans. Look for the Coke.
Look for his fingerprints on the Coke can. It's not as good as his hair.
All right, so there's all sorts of physical trace evidence on devices and in the area surrounding a crime. You come into a room in an investigative mode, the first thing you need to do is realize that there's physical evidence like there's physical evidence in any other crime scene. You need to go collect that. There's also another example. There's lots of examples, and there's lots more than this. Date and time stamps on data in the computer. Okay?
Fine. I got one today. An email, somebody says there are a whole bunch of users sharing a machine,
a Windows NT machine, and all of their Windows or their Netscape cache files are stored in the same directory. How do I demonstrate it was this user? All right, well, somebody actually came up with a better solution than I had, assuming that the system is configured properly, but my solution was, gee, Windows NT tracks when users log in and log off. The file creation and modification and access dates are also tracked with time. Look at the time and date stamp on the file. Compare it to the time and date stamps of users logging in and off, in and out, and that will tell you that this user was logged in at the time that file was created. And that's, you know, it's pieces in the mosaic. Get his fingerprints on the keyboard, that's another piece. Get that he dialed into some computer service and used the password there, that's another piece. Get the fact that he paid for that with his credit card, that's another piece. Go to the bank, get the information that credit card's associated with this person at this address, and happens to have his name, lives at the same place, and that he takes money in and out of the account and spent it on dinner last Tuesday, you've got it. Date and time stamps on data are one of the most ignored pieces of evidence today, and boy, there's tons of this evidence. In fact, I'm going to tell you something. I've told a lot of people this. The problem is not a lack of evidence. The problem is a plethora of evidence. We have too much. There's so much of it, we can never find it all. So the best we can do is build up this mosaic, and it's going to have some pieces missing, because probably I won't find every ISP on the path from here to there and track them down and get their records subpoenaed in time to catch the fact that he logged into here or that his packet went through there, you know, at 2:47 a.m. on Tuesday morning. Telephone records. Okay, we always, you know, we forget the obvious, right? He dialed into his ISP. Well, where did he dial in from? He wasn't magic, he used a telephone. Oh, what phone number did he call from? Oh, it's his home phone number. Done. We got him. Right, we know where he came from. Same with cell phones. Okay? He was in Seattle, and the crime was in New York, and there was dialing from New York, but we know he was in Seattle because we had him physically there at the time. Unless he found a way to dial from Seattle to New York, dialing from New York, he didn't do it. That can be exculpatory. Okay, telephone records, date and time, but you need to match them against each other. ISP access records. When he logs into the ISP, what account he used. I say he, there are also she's that commit crime, although they are predominantly males, at least in terms of one we catch. Stored email. Used Hotmail. Downloaded the email to his local PC, but it's still up on Hotmail. Didn't delete it. Didn't quite get delivered. Got delivered to him, but he left it. He didn't delete it after he did it. Right, the email's still in his stored file. There's all sorts of stored email, not only there, but there might be stored email in other systems in the internet used to deliver that email, if you can get to them soon enough. Backups on tapes and on disks. Okay, you get a file server broken into, and you find out about it 4 months later. The whole system has been racked, you know, munched around, modified. You know, they've gone to other places. We don't know all everything they did. When did it happen? Gee, we don't know. The file date and time modification say it happened about 6 months ago, but we don't actually know. Well, hey, go to the backups. This person came in and modified the system. start going to the backups, go far enough in the backups to where you find an unmodified system, find the backup that has the modified system, you know what happened between one or the other. Okay, there's all sorts of evidence in backups. Backups typically stored on tape, they're very voluminous. It's time consumptive to start at the beginning of the tape, read it all through, image it in, and compare it to the next backup tape. But that's what you need to do to figure out what's going on. You might have to restore it, right? You might have to take the tape, restore the information from it onto a live system so that you can analyze it. Depending on how you want to analyze it, might be more convenient that way. You can always look at the raw bits. Right? The raw bits are always there. If you know enough about how it works, you can always look at them and demonstrate it by looking at them. On the other hand, it's a lot more convenient to use the automation that's built into systems by restoring it, mounting it, and so forth. But you need to make sure that the original evidence is kept safe. What you do is you copy the original evidence off of the tape using electromagnetic means, tape-to-tape copy, if you can afford that, or you call up a guy I know that's down in the L.A. area or San Diego area, one of about five or six people in the country that happens to have every tape drive ever made and is an expert at getting the data off the tape. In fact, he's going to be coming for a guest lecture, right? You pull the data off the tape and put it on another tape, and you save the original evidence. Lock it up in the evidence container. Oh, by the way, make sure you keep it properly. We'll get to that later. You take the copy tape, and now you read that into a computer, and you analyze it and so forth, and you still have the original evidence. So you can go back to the original evidence and reconstruct it live in front of the jury if you have to. More often than not, you don't need to, but that's all right. Network access logs. So, you know, if you go into your computer system and look at all the audit trails, you might find that there are, for example, logs of when email was received or when the emailer was run. You got an email at 2 a.m. Gee, the emailer wasn't run. You were awake all the time. It showed up at 2 a.m. The emailer was not run for remote access between 11 p.m. and 6 a.m. the next morning. Gee, the mail didn't come from the network unless somebody modified those audit trails associated with that network activity. Okay, came from somebody in the system who forged it, would be an example. Look at deleted sectors as web logs at remote sites. You say he went to this remote site and downloaded this stuff. Okay, you have a record here that says he went to that site. At that site, there's probably a record there that says he came here. If they keep records and you subpoena them before they get wiped out, you can associate those two, and now it's pretty much a lock. Right? Because, yeah, he might have forged something on his computer, but how did he go over and forge it on their computer too without breaking into it? Now you're saying he broke into the computer. All right, start telling me how he broke into that computer. You better show that if you're going to claim he did this other thing. So
by correlating this information, you can make a much stronger case one way or the other. By the way, people sometimes think that when you do forensic analysis, you're out to get people. Fundamentally, that's wrong. Fundamentally, as a philosophical issue, when I look at evidence, when you look at evidence, if you care whether somebody's innocent or guilty, you should not be looking at the evidence. Done deal. Okay? You're supposed to be an independent expert examining evidence, you know, scientific data, using the scientific method. If you care if the guy's guilty or not, don't get into the case. Find somebody else. Okay? Fundamentally, you know, I go into places and they say, oh, you're here to catch people. I'm not here to catch people. I don't care whether he did it or not. I don't care at all. They pay me by the hour. Right? I get billable hours. I'm here. I'll read the data as quickly and efficiently as I can. I'll interpret it as effectively as I can. I'll do the best job I can at telling you what happened. My forensic job, right? Figure out what happened. Document it. Be able to reproduce it. That's my job. If what happened is he was home, or he was at the beach when this happened, then that's what I'll say. If what happened is he broke into the bank and stole the money, if that's what the evidence says, that's what I'll say. Now, very rarely does digital evidence say he broke into the bank and stole the money. Digital evidence says stuff like at 2 o'clock in the morning, according to this clock that's tied up to the satellite system, somebody with this user ID and password dialing in from this phone number, which happens to also be his apartment, where he was seen by a friend at the same time on his computer, typed this sequence of characters. The effect of that was that this sequence of events took place.
Yeah.
That's the evidence. That's what you present.
Okay, evidence is late. Let's look for some. These are examples of some commands that you might use in a Unix environment to look for evidence. Grep for fail in /var/log/mess*. We're going to look for messages recorded by the normal audit trail of the operating system that include the word failed in them. So it might be failed attempts to use a service that might be stored in those audit trails on that kind of computer. Different computers, different operating environments have different types of information stored in different locations. But fundamentally, most systems keep some sort of audit trail. Now, DOS systems keep really poor audit trails. Windows systems keep almost no audit trails. Windows NT keeps somewhat better audit trails. You can turn audit trails on and off. Out-of-the-box Linux systems typically don't have detailed logging of user commands turned on, which means that information won't be available. But if it was turned on, then that's more detailed information, who ran what when. There's the bash history file under Linux if they're using the bash command interpreter and so forth. So you can go last log, that'll tell you the last time various users logged in and logged out, and if they're still logged in. You can get a whole history of logins if you want. You can get the commands that were typed, who ran what and when. Requires root access to do that. You can look at /var/log and see whether logs are there and peruse through them to get a sense on your own system of what kind of information you might find. When you do a crime scene reconstruction, what you want to do is get as close to the original system as you can, reenact the crime, and examine what log files were changed in your reconstruction. And then go to the system where the original crime took place, or your image of that system. Hopefully you're not messing with the original evidence. Go to that image and see if that same kind of log entry is in the same kind of log file. That would be a dead giveaway. Okay, and if they're not there, why not? Was logging not turned on? Was logging, if it was turned on and it should have been there, then guess what? That's exculpatory. That says this thing did not happen the way you currently thought it happened, or at least the way you reconstructed it. What was different? You need to figure it out. There's some less obvious ones, like ls minus lag. It has time and date stamps on every file. Even in a DOS system, there are time and date stamps on every file. Even though you can change the date and time on most systems when you turn them on, once a system is running, it's very rare that somebody changes the date and the time in the middle of a sequence of 15 operations, or changes it lots and lots of times. And there's evidence that that happens by the time sequences associated with the timestamps on files. Okay? And there's tons and tons of that evidence. I mean, it might be a million bits of that evidence, or 10 million bits of that evidence in a typical computer system. Another place is the process data. Look at all the processes that are running. Now, you can only do that on a live system, and we typically don't want to do forensics on live systems, not originals, but we might want to do it on our reconstruction. Okay, looking at names of programs, usage times, and so forth. And this is another example of the fact that evidence isn't always, sometimes timeliness is very important. Seeing the process status while a crime is in progress will tell you that this program is running by this user at this moment. If you look at it an hour later, the program is not running, the user is not logged in, the evidence is gone. Which brings up the topic that is often fragile and time sensitive. In fact, sometimes it exists only for very short periods of time. Network traffic. You know how long network traffic exists? Not very long, right? It exists essentially the amount of time that signal stays on the wire. So it's the speed of light propagation of the signal down the wire is how long that evidence exists. If you don't collect it off the wire when it shows up, it's not there. If you're doing something for law enforcement, you better know that you need a warrant to search network traffic. Why do you need a warrant? Because it's intercepting interstate communications, or potentially interstate communications. It's like a telephone tap. You need a warrant to do a tap. If you're a private company and you do a tap, you could get thrown in jail if your employees in that company don't have an agreement that says that the company is authorized to do that. And there's a recent case where the people are under arrest for doing this. It can be very, another thing, telephone conversations, right? That's another kind of evidence. Not only is this for a very short period of time. What's displayed on your monitor? I bust down the door to your room with the gun out and I say, freeze! Okay? What's on your monitor is not going to be there if I turn off the power. It might not be there in a couple of seconds. If you get to touch a button, it might not be there. I need to get that evidence now if I want to have it. It can be easily destroyed or modified. Okay, you have a Palm 3. How hard is it to destroy this evidence? Pull the batteries out of the back, wait 60 seconds, evidence gone. Okay, there are other things that are much faster than that. And of course, I can have a kill key that I punch the button and it takes it out right away. How destroyed it is, how well and thoroughly destroyed it is another question. It turned out it's fairly hard to really do a good job of destroying information stored in digital form. Nevertheless, time is a key issue. It can be easily destroyed or modified. I have it right down here. It can also be easily mishandled. Okay, electromagnetic media. If you drop it, if you smack it, if it has a high impulse against it, this tends to make it lose the data, just like a magnet loses magnetism if you hit it with a hammer. Or you can magnetize it by hitting it with a hammer. Right? Well, if you magnetize the tape, you're changing the magnetism. So you got to be careful how you handle it. And there are a variety of issues in handling it. Temperature. Right? If you have electromagnetic media and you expose it to temperatures over about 110 or 120 degrees for more than a couple of minutes, it's all over. It'll erase the data. So you take your backup tapes, you put them in the back of your car, which is parked in the parking lot on a sunny day, and you go in to get a soda before you leave. Get into your car, it's kind of hot. Gee, the backups are gone. Evidence destroyed. Damaged by shaking or jolting, I mentioned, they can be erased very easily. How hard is it to erase data? You type erase. Lots of people accidentally erase it. Oops, I typed the remove command. File's gone. Oh, no, can't get back. Unless you have a remove that allows you to get it back, which most systems do not have installed by default. Erase doesn't mean destroyed in all cases. Just because you said remove, if I get your system then, forensically, by copying what's off the disk, I can probably go and reconstruct it. Okay, and for some period of time until it's overwritten with other data. And even then, I might still be able to reconstruct it if it's important enough and I have enough time and money to do it by moving the tape heads or the disk heads slightly off center track and picking up old data, as I mentioned before, that can be stored because the disk head doesn't move to an identical physical location every time. And even if that's not good enough, I might be able to do it with an electromagnetic attachment on a scanning electron microscope. I can probably tell the difference if I'm good enough at it and have enough time and money, which might be quite exorbitant. I can probably tell the difference between the first thing written and the second thing written. Okay? So it can be easily erased, but it's possible to reconstruct it with enough time and money in many, many cases. Sensitive to magnetic fields. Okay, so if I bring a magnet by, it's going to change things. If I stick a magnet next to the tape head on your tape machine, it's going to erase the tape. If it's a good enough, strong enough magnet at the right place, it'll erase the tape just after it's written. You'll have done your backups and have no data on them. I can take a big magnetic bulk eraser and wipe out all the data on the tape or on a disk en masse. Okay, now, it depends on how good the tape. Modern tapes, it turns out, are fairly hard to really erase. Also, of course, some of the discs and tapes you get aren't actually new, even though they're sold as new. You might go and actually try and read what's on them in some cases. Examples, data in transmission is only exists as it passes through. Access records are purged daily or weekly from most ISPs.
Okay, most people that have audit trails delete the old audit trails after a period of time. Most people don't examine those old audit trails. The slash bar slash messages from Linux is a typical, or Unix is a typical example. Backups are only retained for days, weeks, months, and so forth. Right? There's only a schedule of retention for backups. And depending on what that retention schedule is, data that only existed for a short period of time may or may not be on the backup. And even if it is on a backup, it might be gone from the backup the next day or the next week or the next month, depending on when things get reused. So timeliness can be very important there. File data is overwritten by newer files. So the time between when you delete it and something else gets written over that disk might be the time frame necessary to secure that evidence. If you want to get it, PDA data is lost when the battery runs out. Remember, if you're going to take this for evidence and put it into the lockup, you take this PDA into the lockup and it's not going to be used for 8 months, good chance that evidence is going to be gone when you get back. This thing has a lot of plastic in it. I don't know if you're aware of this, but there are various living creatures in this world, typically fungi, whatever, that eat plastic and rubber, different kinds of plastic and rubber. So if this thing is held together by rubber or plastic or gum or some other such thing, that gets eaten away with time. Batteries, when they get old, leak acid, right? Lead acid batteries, they leak the acid. And if the acid leaks through here, it might destroy the evidence. So you have to get the evidence off in a timely fashion and often analyzed and turned into a form that's more permanent. Paper doesn't last that long, right? Unless it's acid-free paper, it doesn't last that long. And most paper, you know, 500-year-old, the Constitution of the United States is rotting away despite all our efforts to keep it safe. They can barely keep the paper readable. It's only, 200 years old? A little bit more than 200 years old. Well, fortunately, most evidence doesn't have to last 200 years, but certainly, 4 to 7 years is very common time frames for evidence. Sometimes 14 or 20 years, certainly in appeals cases. It gets even longer than that. Flashcards can be erased in seconds. Examples of very temporary evidence are network traffic, and you can use the TCP dump program, for example, to collect that traffic. You might want to type a control C pretty soon if you're doing that, because a control C will stop its collection. And why would you want to stop it from collecting once you started? And the answer is it gets gotten and got the data. If you collect all the traffic off of a network and it's a 1 megabit per second network, that means you're getting 1 million bits per second or 8 million bits or 1 million bytes, a megabyte, every 8 seconds if that line is fully used. These days, 100 megabit per second wires are commonplace. There are even radio lands that are running at 100 megabits per second. Okay, that's about 10 megabytes per second. Or, 10 gigabytes per 1,000 seconds, or you get to record about 2 hours on a 10 megabit drive. A 10 megabyte drive. A couple of hours you can record, that's it. So how much data you can sniff becomes a limiting factor, and in fact, what you need to do somehow is determine what data you need to collect early on, recognizing the limitation of that, right? What you don't collect, you won't have to analyze. If what you were going to collect might have been exculpatory, you missed that. If it might have convicted them, you missed that too. So figuring out what to collect is very important to doing this effectively, especially in remote sites. Right? You're going to plant a data collection system somewhere. You need to find a way to exfiltrate the information, get the information out. Or if it's going to store it, how much can it store for how long? So you can't just go say, I'm going to gather it all, because it just doesn't work. Also, of course, you're seeing the packets generated by your own processes. So one of the mistakes almost everybody makes when they start to do this is they'll go into a remote system and start dumping all the network traffic. And the first byte they get out is the byte that somebody sent, and the next byte is the byte that's the byte they just sent to themselves. And the byte after that, the byte they just sent to themselves, recording the byte they just sent to themselves. They immediately get into an infinite loop because all the traffic sending them the results of their sniffer is more traffic that the sniffer sniffs. So they just keep getting their own data forever. So you need to be a little bit more selective, at least. There's also programs that will turn this traffic from bits and bytes into text by reading the packets out of the packet format and turning them into the packet content format, separating the headers from the content of the packet and so forth. And there's a program called TCP Show that does that. I have some variations on that. Typically, the off-the-shelf tools that you get are good for casually watching traffic, but not good for forensic analysis, and there are two reasons. One of them is you don't really know what they're sending you because you haven't modified them to do what you want to do, and the other one is that they tend to disassociate data within a given packet. Okay, what you need to do to get the sequence of events that actually took place is gather all of these the streams of things that are going on. In a network, there are a lot of sequences of events taking place, and they're intermixed. Okay, it's like a whole bunch of people going downtown, and some are getting in their cars, and some are getting on trains, and they all sort of start at their homes, they mix all over the highways and stuff, so a bus is like a packet, and a car is like a packet. And what you want to do here is, if you're trying to do is figure out all the people that went from upstate New York into Manhattan, then somehow you need to take this gob of all the traffic passing the place where you put your sniffer, you know, on the Brooklyn Bridge, and you need to somehow associate the sequences of events with the different people going to different places so you can tell what went to where. And those are tools that are not the off-the-shelf tools that you have on the internet. You need to build custom tools that will take this traffic and turn it into the sequences of sessions and search those sequences of sessions to find the sequence of events associated with what you're looking for. If somebody logs into a file server, if you're watching the specific traffic, you can watch them log in. But if you're collecting all the data and you're trying to pick their login out, and you have 10 gigabytes of data that you're collecting, you know, every couple of hours, that's something that you can't do sitting on that PC. There's not enough computing power. There's no off-the-shelf algorithm that's going to hand it to you. It's going to pick off all the logins. It won't work. So either you need better selectivity and collection, or the ability to analyze this. And if it takes too much analysis horsepower to get what you're looking for, then remembering that the data is coming real time, if you wait, it piles up. You need enough processing power to handle it. It might take a fairly substantial parallel processor. Or alternatively, if you've gathered evidence over a period of 6 months and have, you know, 5 terabytes of data, what are you going to do with that? You need a system that can read those 5 terabytes of data and analyze it before, you know, the next millennium comes by. Network traffic is very transitory. It only passes an interface. It never even comes in unless you specifically ask it to. It's so voluminous it cannot be stored in its entirety. Real-time separation can be done based on IP address or service, and that's typically what's used as a starting point. See, we pointed out that meaning is only clear when taken in context. And we're getting towards the end of today's session. I can see that you're starting to get exhausted out in the audience. Too much information coming in. But there's a lot more. Patterns of information combine to provide substance. This is that mosaic effect. And this is going to be thematic through this course, building up this mosaic. Patterns of information combine to provide the substance. It's like a puzzle, and you put it together to get a picture, and it shows Joe's face. It often involves a lot of types of sources of information, not just bits, paper, logs from a lot of different systems, purchase records, sequences of events. Okay, you need to reconstruct this whole picture of the crime. It's not good enough Joe logged into Yahoo as user Joe. And I think we're looking for user Joe because that's who the email came from. Okay, any good defense attorney will say that's not a whole lot of evidence against Joe. We can probably talk the jury out of it based on the fact that in court I just logged in as Joe and Mary just logged in as Joe and everybody else just logged in as Joe. The jury, come log in as Joe. No problem. Now, are you sure it was Joe? Could it have been somebody else? Of course it could. Not very good. Yeah, but we also have some extra evidence. It was from Joe's house. We have the telephone record, kept by the phone company.
Normal business record and admissible.
Under the normal business record exception for the hearsay. Evidence law. All this is hearsay, so hearsay, you know, can only be introduced through expert witness testimony. Okay, so you need to be enough of an expert to be able to say what this means that it's kept in the normal business record and do the interpretation and so forth. But this puzzle, okay, yeah, we got all this digital evidence, but gee, he also sent this thing through the mail. It's mail fraud.
Thank you. I have postage stamp, his fingerprints, his, he licked the stamp, I have his DNA.
I win. Interesting case study that we might look at is who posted the information. And this is a case where we want to provide data, combine data provided by user, email records, date and times of action, access to systems used, date and time accesses, of their accesses, and motive as shown in email. You know, you're trying to put together means, motive, and opportunity to show that this is what happened and this is how it happened. As an example, in audit trails, find the password guessing. Okay, you got a failed login attempt appears, and I think I have a slide on this somewhere, but not here. So left as an exercise for user, but you get a failed login appears in the /var/log7/messages/log file, and it's only accessible from the root unless it's specifically configured to be accessible by others. So you would not be able to see it or modify it unless you were the super user. So we'll look at it, and we'll look for failed, and we find a bunch of failed password entries. And the question is, which of them are attacks where somebody's guessing, and which of them are simple mistakes? So, you know, the notion here is to put it into context. How do you tell a simple mistake from a malicious attack? So give me a sense. What do you think might be a good thing to differentiate malice from accident? Number of failed attempts, right? If it's by accident, 3, 4, 5, 10, eventually they'll call. If it's 5,000, probably not an accident, right? All right, what's the other one? Some of the names they tried to use. They came in from the same place again and again and used different usernames. Gee, a regular user doesn't do that, right? Because he has a specific username and didn't just try two or three, happen to know. We tried, you know, every generic username that's been published on the internet as a possible entry. All right, what else? What's another example? I have some my list here, right? Where is it coming from? Gee, it's coming from a computer in Zimbabwe, and I happen to know that Jim's down the hall. I don't think Jim was in Zimbabwe, and if he went through Zimbabwe to dial in, we need to talk to him anyway. That doesn't make sense, where it comes from. What else came from there? Okay, we got 500 attempted logins from Zimbabwe, but we also got a whole bunch of what appears to be attempts to break into other services using known attack scripts. Gee, looking better. What account were they trying to get into? They were trying to get into an account that doesn't exist and never existed. Or they were trying to get into an account of an employee who was recently fired. Oh, recently fired, account disabled, trying to log in again. Could be an ex-employee accidentally logging into his, you know, bank examiner account. But that doesn't sound very, very right. That's probably pretty darn suspicious. In fact, it's, you know, there's really no legitimate reason they should be there at all. Maybe they don't need to be arrested, but they certainly need to stop it. And probably it's against the law, especially if they have an access code that used to work. That would be potentially illegal possession of an access code. There's specific laws against that. What else is there to know about that account? It was a bank examiner's account. From a guy that was fired, that's a lot more information than somebody was trying to guess a random account. So the specifics of what they're trying to get, what they might be trying to get into based on what they appear to be doing, will help you lead to differentiating between accident and malice. Correlating it to other events. Okay, again, we're talking here about the mosaic, and the key here is that without the mosaic, you don't have much of a picture. All you have is some fact sitting on its own. But you start to put it into context, and you start to come up with these other things. Motive, means, method. Now you start to have a picture of something that looks like, you know, it's evidence, and it gets closer as you gather more of it. So it's easily misinterpreted. I mean, you know, it's often misleading because you go down a lot of false leads. That's the nature of investigation, right? We had somebody come knocking at the door. They said they were from copy or repair, and we've heard about the copy or repair scam. So we think maybe they're trying to get into our place. Yeah, we track them down. Turns out they're from a copier company. You know, they go door to door knocking on doors saying, I'm from copy or repair. You know, we'd like to repair your copier. Okay. Son of a gun. So you got to, you know, follow down the leads, and some of them will not be good leads. And people will ask you about them. Right? If you ever get into court, somebody will say, oh, why didn't you examine this? Well, I did. I looked at it. For a minute, I thought it was this, and then I noticed this thing was turned on, and that was producing these audit records. It was a misconfigured system, so I told the systems administrator he might want to fix this configuration. But that doesn't mean that the guy's innocent or guilty, or depending on what the situation is. It's often patently false, as in somebody intentionally modifies it or creates it to make it look like something that it's not. Especially true on the internet, where it seems to be sport, if nothing else. Certainly lots of people claim false identities on the internet. I mean, people, for example, pedophiles will claim to be, you know, 8-year-old girls talking to other 8 to 10-year-old girls and enticing them to come and meet them after school in the park. Turns out the 47-year-old man is there to molest them. So false identities, you know, things are not always what they seem. So especially things like emails and so forth have a tendency to be just patently false. In some venues and under some circumstances. Although, most of the time, you tend to trust most of the information we get and don't have a reason to distrust it. It's certainly a lot of false information. Forgery is very commonly used. So, IP address forgery is off the shelf. You download it, you guys have seen it, you download it, you run it, it works. Okay? And there are all sorts of people that break into other people's accounts and go from there. And there's lots and lots of evidence. To support this, typically forged email is very often trackable, even though it might appear not to be easily trackable. Very often the header information reveals the details. Very often, even if the headers don't have the detailed audit information from the intervening systems will reveal it. Okay, and, you know, probably for your average email scam, it's not worth going and serving search warrants on the 5 intermediary computers and certain that it went through to prove or disprove where it came from or went to. On the other hand, if somebody's, you know, threatening to kill somebody, or if there's there have been cases where there have been kidnappings where the extortion notes came via email, son of a gun. If you've got an extortion case where there's a kidnapping involved, man, I'll go get the warrants. We'll go and we'll track that email down. And if you lied, we will find out which computer you lied at. And if you think we can't, then, you know, we'll be smiling as you sit in that cell for the rest of your life for what you did. So you can get around it, but it takes a lot of effort, and there has to be enough reason to do that. That's one of the reasons that there tends to be a threshold for committing crimes. Right? If it's too painful, too expensive, then it's worth tracking you down. And if it's too small, it doesn't gain you enough to be worth doing and taking the risk. People go through intermediaries. Very often they'll log into some other system or dial into a phone number or get a free AOL account or something like that and use that as part of the process to get in the free phone cards and the buy for cash phone cards. That's a good one, right? You go out and buy a phone card for cash. You go to some payphone, stick it in and make your call. So those are very often hard to track. Although, if it's important enough, don't believe that you'll get away with it. If it's important enough, it's worth the effort. Groups have a tendency to cover each other. There are numbers of groups out there that participate in illicit activities of various sorts. Some of them are relatively mild and believe that they are innocent. Others are quite malicious. One of the big problems is the people that are there sort of for the free time and the fun time and so forth, very often they're taken advantage of by people that are quite serious. and they end up, you know, being an accessory to a really serious crime because they think that it's play and fun and so forth. But the groups tend to cover each other, and that's why you have a tendency to get more than one of the groups along the way. And you might end up with 30 or 40 people in jail over some poll fraud, like happened in New York when the two groups got mad at each other and started ratting each other out. Records can be intentionally deleted. It's fairly simple to do if you have the access. You just delete the records. On the other hand, it's very often the case that there's evidence of that deletion. Missing time events, okay? We have programs, these daemon programs, these processes that run periodically to do services. And if you delete the records, it's very common that there will be missing records from those things that run periodically. Every 5 minutes, and then it skips an hour, and then every 5 minutes. Excuse me. Looks like nothing happened for an hour in this system. That's not right. There are programs that automatically try and delete things from files or modify things from files, and it turns out there's redundant information in systems. And so if you're not very, very careful about how you do it, you will not have removed all the redundancy, and we'll get you from that. Or we'll get you from the file access time, or the time you ran programs. There's all sorts of evidence in there. It's, you know, we can't always find it all, and there's a level of effort. Insider obstructions. It's not uncommon to have insiders that don't want others to be caught. And often not because they're part of the crime. Sometimes because they're part of the crime. Sometimes because they have some sense of loyalty that maybe is misplaced. And other times just because, you know, you're in their territory and they're going to be obstructionists. So that happens. So you need to understand that these take place so that sometimes when you get misled, it's because somebody was, you know, part of the crime, and sometimes they said, I don't want you on my turf. I know how to do this. Okay, well, you know, we're investigations. That's what we got to do. You also get, boy, a lot of low-quality experts, easily misinterpreted. Okay, so I had an expert witness. He turned out he was appointed as a special master, which means that essentially that the judge said, you're going to be relatively authoritative in this case, all right, even though he was clearly on one side. Put in a special master, and he goes and he looks at the system and he says, you know, this file means that they went here on Tuesday at 3 p.m. Looked at it and said, excuse me, no it doesn't. That file is not created by going there at Tuesday at 3 p.m. That file is created by a completely different program. You just got the names wrong. They got them confused. It's the wrong program. Gee, there's a file on this system that says, you know, January 12th, 2004. All the dates and times are wrong in the system because of that. No, they're not. Yes, some dates and times in the system are not right. But we've got this mosaic. Yeah, this says that at 2:35 in the morning, this happened. Well, if we take a look, this computer's time, you know, we will correlate that it happened to this dial-up record from the telephone system and find out that this computer, according to that dial-up record and this file, was off by 2 days, 3 hours, and 47 minutes and 12 seconds at the time that this happened. So things around that time will tend to be correct in a relative time base, which brings up the whole issue of time. And in computer systems, relative time is very, very important. Because in order to say that something happened at 2 o'clock on Tuesday, it's necessary that 2 o'clock on Tuesday be the same everywhere, and it's not. First of all, you can set the time and date in your computer intentionally wrong in a certain second, and of course you can do it by accident. And it happens all the time. In fact, computers normally get off time if you just leave them alone. So if some of them are using network time protocol, in which case they're very accurate, typically within milliseconds of the true time as gotten by the atomic clock run at the Naval Observatory, or off the satellites, the global positioning system sends very accurate time and date information all the time. But most of the time, people have differentials associated with different time zones, different clock settings on their computer, and so forth. So anytime you're going to be dealing with evidence, when you have a system, you need to sort of figure out some correlation of its notion of time to the notion of time for the rest of the world. And then translate everything between the two. And doing time translation is a non-trivial thing, but if you know how to do it, you can do it, and then things become correlated that were previously uncorrelated. And what's very fascinating is, you can think of this sort of like pictures of hair, right? You have a picture of a hair or a bullet. There are striations on a bullet created by
their movements through the barrel of the gun, through the rifle. And if you take two pictures of the bullet, or if you slice the bullet in half, and you rotate it, you'll see striations, but they'll all be out of alignment with each other. It looks like there's no match. But as you rotate it around, you get to the right place, and they're perfectly aligned. Okay, the same thing happens with these time differentials in computer systems. Okay, you start moving the time ahead or back, and all of a sudden, internal events line up with external events. And when you start to get all the internal lining up with all the external, you know you have the times right with respect to each other. And in fact, you can show mathematically, if you try hard, that there are a fairly small number of cases in which that alignment will happen that way. And you can sort of list all the alignments that are possible, and then figure out, if you need to, which one is the proper alignment. Okay, so that's an example of the sort of the mathematics and the scientific basis and the analytical aspects associated with doing that proper interpretation of dates and times. There are also people with axes to grind. Okay, and especially in the court system as it exists, there are lots of people who, for one reason or another, want to support a position as opposed to supporting the facts and the science. Okay, and if you're going to support a position, you're in the wrong place. Okay, if you're talking to me, I don't care. If I care, I should not be on the case, and that's all there is to it. Okay, if it's Greenpeace that's testifying about some ecosystem situation, they have an axe to grind. They're going to have a point of view. Well, that's fine in that role. But the role of an expert witness testifying about digital evidence is to get at the facts, to give a proper, accurate reconstruction of what took place according to the facts. If there are alternative interpretations, to present them and demonstrate what the evidence is in favor and against them, and make an accurate judgment about what took place, or determine that they cannot tell what took place beyond some certain level of certainty, and indicate that. Okay, case study. Special master, I told you, made claims, may have been altered data, date and times were unreliable, system never worked when it was handed back to the defendant, the programs were destroyed, the data was not present on the computers when it was originally collected as evidence. Okay, it was all refuted. There were recorded statements of the defendant saying, well, the computer sure looks like it works. Videotape, right? One of the claims was there was a floppy disk in the floppy drive that just looked like it worked. Videotape, you go look at the videotape, you zoom in, son of a gun, you can tell if there's a floppy in a 1.44 floppy drive because the floppy's sitting there and the flap's open. And you look at the videotape, there's no floppy there. Okay, claim gone. Okay, there's all sorts of evidence. The physics of forgery determined that in the amount of time between when the evidence was actually picked up and when it appeared at the evidence lab, where it's signed in and so forth, was approximately the proper travel time. But even if they, along the way, had plugged it into a computer and tried to forge the data, there wasn't enough time to physically write the amount of data that was found on that system in the travel from here to there. You couldn't do it with the physical disk. Could not work. Okay, end of story. Okay, correlation with other records. Yeah, okay, you think the time's right. Yeah, you think that all the times are wrong, but son of a gun, the file modification date here corresponds to the telephone call they made, corresponds to login on an ISP, corresponds to storage of data on this computer over here, all at half time, that's good within a couple of seconds of the atomic clock. So your claim that the time on the system wasn't accurate enough to tell when they did what is vacuous. You lose. Another example is trying to forge email. It's very easy to do. You telnet to a computer on port 25, you say hello and give it an IP address, you say mail from, receive to, put in your data, enter a message, put a period, enter, put quit, and you're done. And the email is there. By the way, don't try this at home. There is jurisdictions in which it is illegal to use a false identity to perpetrate a fraud or to do anything other than what's clearly a demonstration. And there are some exceptions and affirmative defenses, but normally you don't want to just do this. Certainly you can do it on systems
specifically intended for the purpose of demonstrating that. And that's, of course, what we provide with the courses and systems like what you have available. You go and read the email, and the mailer will typically allow you to look at the email in different ways. Okay? And, for example, I use the Elm email receiver on some systems, and if you type H, it'll show you the header information, which will tell you, among other things, the IP address that it came from. So if you lie about the name of the system it came from, even though the mail might get through, the IP address is still properly recorded based on the packets that came in. So email forgery is not that simple. It can be done in some cases, but you need to identify systems that allow you to get that forgery through successfully. And there are fewer and fewer of those available because people don't like to be taken advantage of. We're going to take the break now. That's the end for today, and we're going to continue in our next session, whenever that may be, with this slide with computer forensics is all about.